That was an amazing opening to the conference, but we're going right into our first panel of the afternoon. My name is Joseph Vandy Bogart. I am the president of the Broward County chapter of the Federal Society, and once again, welcome to the 8th Annual Florida Chapters Conference. This will be our first panel discussion of the conference, although I must say, wow, what an opening. This panel is going to be on Florida redistricting 2010s compared to the 2020s. Redistricting is an important government function every 10 years after each census. Here in Florida, we have certain constitutional and legal requirements that affect redistricting. Of note is that Florida has had a few changes on the Florida Supreme Court I know we're all aware of in the last few years since Governor DeSantis was elected, and it's going to be interesting to see how those changes on the Florida Supreme Court may affect redistricting. And thus, it's my distinct pleasure to introduce the moderator of our panel this morning, directly to my left here on the end, Judge Meredith Sasso. Judge Sasso was raised in Tallahassee, Florida. She is a double Gator and received her law degree from the University of Florida in 2008. After law school, Judge Sasso began her career in private practice. And in August of 2016, Judge Sasso joined the office of the General Counsel to Governor Rick Scott, where she ultimately served as Chief Deputy General Counsel. Judge Sasso joined the 5th District Court of Appeal in January of 2019 after being appointed by Governor Rick Scott. So please join me providing a warm welcome to Judge Sasso. Thank you.
Thank you, Joey, for that introduction, and thank you all for making the decision to forego a beautiful Florida Friday afternoon outside to be inside, learn about redistricting law. We are still going to attempt to end this panel, we're going to end this panel on time, so I will briefly introduce our panelists in the order in which they will speak. Please know that these are abbreviated introductions, and you will be able to find their more detailed biographies on the Federalist Society website. Each panelist will then deliver their remarks. They will then have an opportunity to respond to each other or ask each other questions, and then I will then open it up for audience questions. Directly to my left, Mr. Philip Gordon is a partner at Holtzman Vogel, where his practice focuses primarily on the areas of redistricting, voting rights, and the First Amendment and other campaign finance and election-related matters. He has authored major briefs on behalf of parties at the Supreme Court of the United States, the Supreme Court of Texas, and courts of appeals throughout the country. Prior to joining the firm, Mr. Gordon served as associate counsel for the 58th Presidential Inaugural Committee. He holds a law degree from Baylor Law School, where he served as the president of the Baylor Law Chapter of the Federalist Society. He will be giving a brief overview of federal and Florida redistricting law. Next, we have Dr. Michael P. McDonald, who is a professor of political science at the University of Florida. His research interests are the areas of elections and methodology. He's a co-principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project and is a co-author of publications, including The Public Mapping Project, How Public Participation Can Revolutionize Redistricting. His research has appeared in several journals, including the American Political Science Review. He has worked for national exit poll organizations. He's consulted with the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. He has worked as a redistricting consultant and as an expert witness, and he is frequently quoted in various media outlets, including the Associated Press, ABC, and NBC. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of California, San Diego, and a BS in economics from the California Institute of Technology. He will be speaking on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the 14th Amendment, and Tier 1 Florida constitutional requirements for redistricting. And last but not least, we have Professor Michael T. Morley. He's a professor at FSU Law, where he joined in 2018. He teaches and writes in the areas of election law, constitutional law, remedies, and the federal courts. His research focuses on election emergencies, the constitutional right to vote, and the Electoral Count Act. He has testified before Congress, he's made presentations to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, and he's participated in bipartisan blue ribbon groups to develop election reforms. He was also appointed by the governor of Florida to the Criminal Punishment Code Task Force. His work has been published in law reviews, including the Georgetown Law Journal, and cited by the United States Supreme Court. He's also appeared in various media outlets, including C-SPAN, Fox News, and the Washington Post. Professor Morley earned his JD from Yale Law School, and he will be speaking on political gerrymandering constraints in Florida, and as well as the independent state legislature doctrine. And with that, I'll turn to Mr. Gordon.
Thank you, Judge Sasso. I'm Philip Gordon, as the good judge said. This is the short, this was going to be the short 10,000-foot version of redistricting law, both in federal and Florida. Now that we're under such time constraints, this is going to be, to quote my favorite movie, Spaceballs, the short version of that topic. So bear with me, and I'm going to skip some things, and this is no means fully extensive. You can catch me at the bar later, and we can talk about it. So the to truly understand the Florida scheme for redistricting, you need to understand federal law. So as a basis, federal law, you have the census every 10 years. That sort of triggers redistricting throughout the states because there's apportionment of the number of representatives throughout the states. There's very few federal laws really to do with redistricting, the primary one really being the Voting Rights Act, which we're gonna get to in quite some depth, but there's also 2 USC 2A, 2 USC 3. These are really sort of minor laws. And then there's some constitutional provisions that are very important, such as Article 1, Section 2, which is the sort of the apportionment provision. There's the Elections Clause at Article 1, Section 4. And there is obviously the Civil War Amendments, specifically the 14th and 15th Amendment. So going right into it, I'm gonna go by sort of claims in the federal sphere. Partisan gerrymandering, this one's really easy now. After Rucho v. Common Cause, there is no longer a partisan gerrymandering claim in the federal system. It's a non-justiciable political question. Done. Moving on. Malapportionment claims. Malapportionment extends from the Supreme Court's one person, one vote doctrine. So you have Westbury versus Sanders, which is congressional districts, Reynolds v. Sims, which is the sub-congressional districts. And so what you have is a one person, one vote mandate for congressional districts. The practical matter, what the case law says, is you basically can only go plus or minus one person for congressional districts, absent a strong state policy. And when they say strong state policy, they really mean it. So for instance, you have Iowa, who has a very strong state policy in favor of keeping counties whole. They're allowed to deviate maybe a couple hundred people. In a state like, say, Pennsylvania, where they haven't had such a policy, a congressional map was overturned there that differentiated between 17 people. So really, your safest bet is plus or minus one person. Below that level, there's sort of it's not a safe harbor. They're very careful about not calling it a safe harbor, but plus or minus 5% for, say, state legislative districts. If you're within that, then it's a sort of burden-shifting regime where the plaintiff has to prove something. If it's under 10%, then a burden shifts to the state to justify it. Moving on. Okay, now racial gerrymandering. This is where we sort of get into the weeds. Racial gerrymandering claims under the 14th Amendment, really I should say intentional racial gerrymandering claims under the 14th Amendment, require that a plaintiff prove that race was the predominant factor motivating a legislator's decision. What happens then if the plaintiff can make that showing, the burden shifts and to the state to justify their racial considerations under strict scrutiny. The Supreme Court of the United States has long assumed, not presumed, not decided, not held, assumed that compliance with the Voting Rights Act is one way to meet strict scrutiny. They've assumed this for over 50 years. I don't know when they're gonna get around to deciding it, but it's assumed for right now. And that's Cooper v. Harris, if anybody's out there keeping score and really wants to look this up. Then there's Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So Section 2 claims under the Voting Rights Act are what are called vote dilution claims. Excuse me. Vote dilution claims fall under a precedent of Thornburg v. Jingles. It's Jingles, not Gingles. And it's, oh, by the way, it's gerrymandering, not gerrymandering, and I'll have that fight with you out and outside. So there's three factors that you have to meet all of them to prove a vote dilution claim as a plaintiff under the Voting Rights Act and under Thornburg v. Jingles. So there's numerosity and compactness, there's minority political cohesiveness, and there's majority block voting. All of these require expert witness testimony. Mostly the expertness, basically the second two factors are math heavy. The first one is map heavy, and a lot of the fights tend to revolve around whether the minority group is significantly large and geographically compact to form an actual district that would qualify under the Voting Rights Act. Now, I will say there's some fights about this, whether crossover districts are permitted or allowed, or some other sort of combination of political factors with minority representation. But again, short version, moving on. Something else that's important to consider with all of these, but especially when you're looking at the Voting Rights Act cases, is what's called traditional districting criteria. That's compactness, contiguity, keeping political boundaries whole, some social factors, maybe looking at incumbents' addresses, that type of stuff, and that's going to become important later when we get to Florida. Now there's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. This is going to be another quick one. After Shelby County v. Holder struck down the coverage formula, there are no more Section 5 claims in the federal system. However, there is a Section 5 analog. Broadly speaking, there's no more Section 5 claims in the federal system. There is a Section 5 analog in Florida law and the Constitution that we'll talk about. And also, let me just mention briefly a provision called Section 3C. It's what's called bail-in. It's where if you can prove certain elements as a remedy, the court can basically subject a certain jurisdiction to effectively a pre-clearance regime via the courts, not via the Attorney General's office under the old Section 5. Now, Florida redistricting law. I'm doing pretty good. So, there are, the Florida Constitution was recently amended 10 years ago, and they added two different categories, as it were, of requirements. Each item within, so there's category A and category B. Everything within the first category is co-equal with itself. Everything in the second category is co-equal with itself. Everything in the first category sort of trumps everything in the second category. So that's where we're at. So the first category basically states that you cannot, districts cannot be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or an incumbent. So that right there, that's a sort of a partisan gerrymandering situation. You can't, districts cannot be drawn with the intent or result of denying or abridging the equal opportunity of a racial or language minority to participate in the political process or to diminish their ability to elect the representatives of their choice. So with that one, you have both the effect sort of regime under the Voting Rights Act, and you have the intent, or not the intent, you have the intent and effect regime under the Voting Rights Act there, and then under the second, the non-diminishment provision, which I think is going to be a hot topic, is mirrors sort of Section 5-ish. That's what sort of what the Florida courts have said so far. The second category are that the they need to be, the districts need to be nearly as equal in population as is practicable. They must be compact, and where feasible, you have to utilize existing political and geographic boundaries. Oh, the one I forgot out of the first criteria set is contiguousness, which just means you can't have a part of a district over here and then have a big blank space and part of a district over here. You're not allowed to do that in federal law either. So, for partisan gerrymandering claims in Florida, what does this mean? The Florida Supreme Court has basically held, and again, paraphrasing here, that sort of any political considerations are sort of forbidden under Florida law. Now, this is interesting in that there's also some case law that says you can have political figures in front of you when you're map drawing, because the political figures are actually required for the other provisions of the Florida Constitution. So mere access to political data is not a per se violation, but basically they sort of imported a intentional racial discrimination scheme sort of for this, where they say first, you know, plaintiff proves that political considerations were used, any not predominated but used, and then the burden shifts. Now, I don't know how that works, you know, work in practice if it ever is applied, but it's there. the racial considerations from the first set of factors, the Florida Supreme Court has held in In Re Senate Joint Resolution 1176, which I expect you to remember, the Florida Constitution follows almost verbatim the requirements embodied in the Voting Rights Act. So the effect test of vote dilution claims, they sort of incorporate the Thornburg v. Jingles sort of line of cases. And they've also said that the Section 5 sort of retrogression line of cases is under the non-diminishment provision of the first set of criteria under the redistricting amendments that were passed. And go me, the short version.
All right, thank you. Professor McDonald.
Thank you, Judge Sasso. Thank you, Phil, for that wonderful review. And thank you to the Federalist Society for asking me to speak with you today. So I'm going to talk about maybe a little bit more nuts and bolts, but practical applications of what Phil was just describing to you about the law and the case law as it regards voting rights here in Florida in particular. Florida is an interesting state because, unlike some other states, we actually have some protections, voting rights protections, that are found in our state constitution. They were adopted by voters in 2010 as part of those Fair Districts Amendments. All right, so Florida, unlike lots of other states, we have to worry about both the federal law and we have to worry about the state law. And there's interesting dynamics here that happen when you have to worry about both. And we're seeing some of that play out right now in some of the actions that are being taken by the governor, Governor DeSantis, and some of the court action that is likely going to happen here in Florida. So just to reiterate some of the things that Phil was saying about voting rights, important for consideration are two constitutional and statutory provisions in federal law. The constitutional provision deals with 14th Amendment equal protection claims. And if you're using race, if you're looking at race when you're drawing districts, then strict scrutiny comes into play, and all of the requirements of strict scrutiny have to be met at that point. Compelling state interest, narrowly tailored districts. Essentially, this means that you have to have what we often think of are as Goldilocks districts. The Goldilocks districts, they can't have too many of a particular racial group, but they can't have too few. Too many, you've overpacked them and you're diminishing their ability to elect their candidate of choice, maybe in another district. Too few, and they won't be able to elect a candidate of choice. So you gotta have that bowl of porridge, which is just right. So to do that, we do these statistical analyses. I do a lot of them in my expert witness work, working as a consultant to redistricting authorities across the country. You have to look at the voting data. You look at the precinct level. You try and figure out the racial voting patterns within precincts. That's the technique that is used and the courts have approved at the federal level and at the state level here in Florida. So you have to draw these Goldilocks districts, and under certain circumstances with the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act also lays out reasons, situations where the population's got to be large enough, got to be compact enough to draw districts. I want to mention just a couple of lawsuits that are related, and there's ongoing court action right now that are going to likely play out here in Florida over the next couple months. They're relevant to them. We've already talked about Thornburg v. Jingles. Case called Bartlett v. Strickland said that in order to have a claim, a Section 2 claim, a plaintiff has to be able to draw a district that has 50% or more of that minority's voting age population within the district. And it has to be done in a way that also respects the criteria that the state is using for drawing districts, sort of traditional redistricting principles. Another case, Bethune Hill v. Virginia Board of Elections, said that when you're drawing these districts, you can't just pull a number out of thin air. You can't just have a target number of say 50% black voting age population. That's to establish the Section 2 claim. But when you're actually drawing the district, you can't overpack the minorities more than what you need in order to elect a candidate of their choice. And so that's where these statistical analyses come into play. They're very important to establish what that Goldilocks number is to draw a district. So Bethune-Hill says you can't just pull one out of the air. And I was involved in the Virginia litigation that was companion to Bethune-Hill that overturned the Virginia districts as a racial gerrymander, the Virginia congressional districts. So I'm very much aware of that. There's another interesting case that just over the last week or so has come to the fore, and that involves Alabama. Alabama drew only one African-American majority district, and plaintiffs brought a challenge under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and said you could draw a second one. And a three-judge panel, including two Trump appointees, said, we agree, this is a cut-and-dried Section 2 case. The state of Alabama has appealed that case, it's Castor v. Merrill, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, the argument that Alabama's making is saying, no, the plaintiffs had to look at race in an impermissible way when they were coming up with this 50% district, and it violates the traditional redistricting principles in Alabama. And the plaintiffs are saying, no, of course we had to look at race because we had to show the demonstration district under the Section 2. And so we did that, and we're not violating the requirements of the Voting Rights Act. That's going to go up to before the Supreme Court. And it's going to have ramifications if the Supreme Court decides to side with the state of Alabama, that could really unravel Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as it applies to redistricting in a very fundamental way. As just an opinion, so, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't take my legal opinion. But as my opinion, looking across the states, in some states, the Voting Rights Act in Section 2 is constraining Republicans, like in Alabama is a very good example of it. But in some other states, it's actually constraining Democrats because they're being forced to draw districts that are more Democratic than they would otherwise like to make. And so it's not actually very clear if the Supreme Court does away with Section 2, at least as it with respect to redistricting, what's the partisan winner? Who wins? It's not entirely clear because a state like California might then have more reign, although they have a voting rights provision in their state constitution. Maybe not the best example. Maybe another state like Arizona or another state that has a concentration of minorities. They might be able to draw more districts that are spreading out minorities more than what they currently must do under Section 2. So it's not clear. We can look at Alabama and say, yes, there, we can see the winner or loser potentially politically here in Alabama, but what that means in terms of partisanship nationally, that's it's unclear as to who would actually benefit, which of the two parties would benefit. All right, let me get to Florida. I know we have very limited time. So all this comes to head in Florida, because Florida has these fair districts provisions. And in Tier 1, there's a requirement that not only do you have to draw districts under certain circumstances, like with the Thornburg v. Jingles Section 2 cases, but there's also a diminished ability to elect. And that means that's a whole other different legal framework. And in that situation, you can have districts that are less than 50% of a minority population, and they are performant for that population. And so the legislature, looking at the Fair Districts Amendments, said, we need to protect District 5, Congressional District 5. It's that district that stretches from Tallahassee to Jacksonville. Even though you can't draw a 50% black voting age population district there, it still needs to be protected. The Senate drew districts that were less than 50% minority, Hispanic, or African American, and said those are protected. The House did the same. In fact, the House went as low as 29% black voting age population in two districts and said that those were protected districts. Now, interestingly, the House has said that they have done this statistical analysis and they've come to the determination that those districts are required under fair districts. The Senate has not said that they have done that, either for the congressional plan that which they did pass or their own Senate map. They said they've been doing a functional analysis, but it's not the statistical analysis that I'm talking about. And it could put the Senate in hot water unless they've actually done their homework. And so we'll have to see if, I don't know, maybe through discovery or something else, that we find that the Senate actually did their due diligence and did the statistical analysis they need to do in order to determine the voting patterns for whites and for different minority communities to determine whether or not you actually got that Goldilocks district. That's required. That's the Bethune-Hill decision. It said you can't do that. That's the Supreme Court. It was a 6-2 decision. The Supreme Court says you can't do that. Enter Governor DeSantis. He doesn't particularly like the 5th Congressional District. He thinks that it's violating our Fair Districts Amendments. And he says we should not draw that district. And so he has asked for an advisory opinion from the Florida Supreme Court to find out whether or not the 5th Congressional District is required under Fair Districts. Up to this point, the legislature believes so. They've been at least saying the words about protected districts, and the House did a racial block voting analysis. It appears that they believe so, but the Senate passed a congressional plan. The House put their passage of the congressional plan on hold, pending that advisory opinion from the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know what this would actually mean for the state legislative plans if the state Supreme Court would say, the fair districts diminish ability to elect language does not protect the 5th Congressional District or any district that's under 50%. I don't know what would happen. I don't know. The Senate's already passed their map. It was approved by the House. The Senate hasn't actually passed the House map that passed the House yet. So I don't know what would happen with state legislative plans, but we know the congressional plan is on hold at the moment. And so the stakes are pretty high. The stakes are pretty high for Section 2 federally with that Alabama case. The stakes are pretty high for minority representation here in Florida, where there are actually additional protections that go beyond the federal protections here in Florida per our state constitution. And so we'll have to see what happens. And of course, there will be lots of litigation. I'm sure Phil will be part of that, and others maybe in this room. And I look forward to you, deposing me on, and crossing me on the stand. So I'm glad again to be able to talk with you. He will be,
And I'm sorry. Hello?
Yeah, it looks like they do want to.
They're cutting me off. All right. And I'm sorry. And since you raised that, I should have started this. I should have done my law thing. Everything I say here is me, not representative of my firm, not representative of any client. And then now we can move on because I've said my thing.
Thank you. And thank you, Professor McDonald.
Yeah, thank you.
Professor Morley.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to have the opportunity to speak with you today, especially with Star Wars Rise of the Resistance just over the lake there. So thank you for coming. I'll be speaking about the Florida Constitution's protections against political gerrymandering, as well as the potential impact of several Supreme Court justices' recent opinions discussing an idea called the Independent State Legislature Doctrine. As you've heard, a few years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court's 2019 ruling in Rucho v. Common Cause held that political gerrymandering claims are non-justiciable under the U.S. Constitution. The court declared, quote, "Federal courts are not equipped to apportion political power as a matter of fairness, nor is there any basis for concluding that they were authorized to do so." The court went on to reject the evidentiary basis underlying many political gerrymandering claims, stating, "Asking judges to predict how a particular districting map will perform in future elections risks basing constitutional holdings on unstable ground outside judicial expertise." The court concluded, however, by pointing out that states are actively addressing political gerrymandering on a number of fronts. It specifically mentioned the fact that provisions in state statutes and state constitutions can provide standards and guidance for state courts to apply. Florida is a primary example of a state whose constitution expressly prohibits political gerrymandering. The Fair Districts Amendment was added to the Florida Constitution in 2010 through a voter initiative. The amendment provides, as we've been discussing, that congressional and legislative districts must be contiguous and may not be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or incumbent, or with the intent or effect of denying or abridging the equal opportunity of racial or language minorities to participate in the electoral process and elect the representatives of their choice. After the amendment's adoption, two U.S. representatives challenged its constitutionality as applied to congressional elections, raising an argument based on the so-called independent state legislature doctrine. They pointed out, as the Supreme Court has recognized, that states lack any inherent power to regulate federal elections. Their only authority to do so, including the authority to draw congressional district lines, comes from the U.S. Constitution. The Elections Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, does not confer this power on the state as an entity, but rather pierces the veil of statehood, so to speak, by granting it specifically to the legislature of each state. The Presidential Electors Clause in Article 2 similarly confers authority on the legislature to determine the manner in which presidential electors are appointed. Accordingly, when a legislature regulates federal elections under this doctrine, it acts independently of the state constitution's restrictions, pursuant to a distinct independent grant of authority from the U.S. Constitution. The plaintiffs argued that a state constitution therefore cannot impose substantive restrictions on power that the U.S. Constitution confers directly on a state legislature. In the 2012 case Brown versus Secretary of State, the 11th Circuit rejected that argument. That court pointed to Supreme Court precedent saying that the word legislature, as used in the Elections Clause, does not refer specifically to a state's institutional legislature. Rather, the court held, the term more broadly encompasses the entire lawmaking processes of the state, including the public initiative process. A sharply divided U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice Kennedy, reached the same conclusion 3 years later in Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission over Chief Justice Roberts' vigorous dissent. The Florida Supreme Court went on to enforce the Fair Districts Amendment in 2015, ultimately coalescing in League of Women Voters of Florida versus Detzner. The Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's finding that the legislature's 2012 congressional redistricting plan was drawn in violation of the Florida Constitution's prohibition on partisan intent. It ordered the legislature to redraw 8 particular districts whose boundaries, the court concluded, had been impacted by that unconstitutional intent or that otherwise violated the Fair Districts Amendment. Several opinions from individual U.S. Supreme Court justices issued over the course of the 2020 election cycle suggest a potential willingness to embrace the independent state legislature doctrine, raising questions about the continued enforceability of state constitutional provisions that would apply to federal elections, such as the Fair Districts Amendment. Justice Alito, joined by Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, for example, expressed skepticism about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision to invalidate, under the state constitution, a state law specifying that election officials had to receive completed absentee ballots by the close of polls on election day for those ballots to be valid, at least insofar as the court's decision applied to federal elections. Justice Alito opined, "The provisions of the federal constitution conferring on state legislatures, not state courts, the authority to make rules governing federal elections would be meaningless if a state court could override the rules adopted by the legislature simply by claiming that a state constitutional provision gave the courts the authority to make whatever rules it thought appropriate for the conduct of a fair election." Opinions from Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh in other cases likewise spoke approvingly of other closely related aspects of the independent state legislature doctrine. Due to the U.S. Supreme Court's 2015 ruling in Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, as well as the 11th Circuit's ruling in Brown, the independent state legislature doctrine is not currently good law, and Florida's Fair District Amendments remain fully enforceable with regard to congressional elections. It appears that there may be at least 4 votes on the Supreme Court to recognize the doctrine, however, along with a possible 5th vote if you count Chief Justice Roberts' dissent in the Arizona redistricting case. Even if the court were to ultimately endorse the doctrine and hold that state constitutions cannot impose substantive limits on legislatures' authority concerning federal elections, that doesn't mean legislatures can simply run amok. First, the Fair District Amendments would remain in force in Florida with regard to state legislative districts. And even with regard to the regulation of federal elections, the legislature would remain bound by the 14th Amendment and other voting rights amendments to the US Constitution, the inherent restrictions of the Elections Clause and Presidential Electors Clause, and federal laws, such as the Voting Rights Act that we've been discussing, as well as the National Voter Registration Act and other statutes. I expect that the court will provide some clarity on this issue, one way or another, within the next few years. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all the panelists for their opening remarks, and now that you've all had an opportunity to hear each other, do you have any responses or questions for each other? And we can start with Mr. Gordon again.
Sure. I actually think, if anything, Professor McDonald sort of undersold the tensions that exist within and amongst the various laws at play here, especially in the Voting Rights Act sort of zone. Because not only is there tensions between Florida law and federal law, but there's also tensions within federal law, especially as it relates to intentional racial discrimination claims under the 14th Amendment and Voting Rights Act claims under Section 2, because of this process that you have to do, where you have to look at race for Section 2 to see if you need a district that comports with Section 2, but you looked at race already, so now are you, pick your word, under the 14th Amendment, and there's sort of this, like, you know, it's sort of problems all the way down. It can become very circular, and of course the Supreme Court has elicited no safe harbor, and so I think that's, I mean, the state of play in that sort of realm of the law is, it's a, I don't know, thicket, to put it mildly.
I would just agree. I gave the Cliff Notes version for our abbreviated session. I teach this over 3 weeks in the class that I teach, so you got what the 10-minute version of it. So there's a lot of complexity here, and there's a lot of tension between two, the Fair Districts Amendments and the federal law. And so I think without doing that racial block voting analysis, at least what the Senate has said is their quote-unquote functional analysis, is opening them to a 14th Amendment claim. And so, but again, if the state Supreme Court comes in and changes what's required under fair districts, then you have maybe that jeopardy goes away if you revise and revisit what you did with your Senate map. So again, it's really complicated and was very fluid right now. And without a doubt, there's gonna be some litigation.
And we may have time for one or two audience questions. If you have one, you can start walking up to the mics. Professor Morley, anything to add?
I think the prediction of litigation is a safe bet.
One question, can one of you all give color to what this looks like from an evidentiary perspective? We're talking about motivations and intent. What can we expect to see in litigation?
So I guess I'll start. It's an evidentiary mess. Back to you, Judge. No, but really, it's. So the Florida Supreme Court has already decided that there's more or less no legislative privilege when it comes to any claims regarding partisan gerrymandering under the Florida Constitution, because the reasoning being that when enacting the constitutional amendment, they sort of abdicated that right. And as a practical matter, it would be hard to sort of find the circumstantial evidence you need to prove such a claim without being able to get certain documents or testimony from legislators. So that's definitely an evidentiary question. It's certainly a more complicated one on the federal level, but that's sort of the elevator pitch version.
I would just add that both the Florida Constitution and the Federal Voting Rights Act is written in terms of results, effects and results. There is an intent clause in or phraseology in the Florida Constitution, but usually the evidentiary standard is about the effects. And that's where you get into these statistical analyses that are done to determine, is that the Goldilocks district or not? And so, you know, from my perspective, it is, it's a bit of an art to interpret the data, because you never get a single number, and that's where experts opine on things. But these analyses are well grounded and they've developed over 30 years of litigation in this area. So we kind of know what we're doing. We know the data we need. We know the sort of tools that we're going to bring to bear to analyze that data. So from my perspective as an expert, I think finding those results, those effects standards, it's pretty cut and dried, much like what the three-judge panel found in Alabama.
The intent issue is definitely much more prevalent with regard to political gerrymandering cases, and especially the language of the Fair Districts Amendment is different when comparing the political gerrymandering to racial gerrymandering. And if you look at the example of the case that went up to the Supreme Court, the Detzner, the court went through the evidentiary record to try to determine, number one, could it identify particular legislators or even staffers who had unconstitutional intent, who wanted to have a partisan advantage? And then one of the big questions that arises then is very similar, actually, to a question that arises in the statutory interpretation context in the debate between textualism versus intentionalism. This notion that the legislature is a they, not an it, right? The legislature is composed of numerous members, and so under what circumstances then do you attribute, even if there is a partisan intent on behalf of certain staffers or certain members, under what circumstances can you then attribute that intent to the legislature as a whole? In the Detzner case, the court found that the evidence was enough to allow it to attribute that intent to the legislature, right, as an institution or as an entity. That will always be one of the most difficult issues in these cases.
All right. Well, we are about out of time. Thank you all so much for cramming so much into a short amount of time and for being here today. And with that, we give our panel a round of applause.